Hello and welcome to this BJS podcast. I'm Wendy Barnaby, and today we'll be hearing about three papers in the June issue of the journal. They're about transplantation. Our speakers will be Mr. Gavin Pettigrew from the Cambridge Transplant Centre at Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge, UK, and Mr. Michael Silver, consultant surgeon at the Department of Hepatobiliary, Pancreatic and Transplant Surgery at the Churchill Hospital, Oxford University Hospitals, NHS Trust. There's an acute shortage of donor organs for transplantation, and this has increased the use of organs transplanted from donors whose heart has stopped beating. These grafts are exposed to longer periods of oxygen starvation than ones from brain-dead donors, and they're also affected by what happens during the agonal phase of death. Our first paper describes an early single-centre experience of simultaneous pancreas and kidney transplantation from controlled donation from donors following circulatory death. Let's turn to Gavin Pettigrew, who's one of the authors of this paper. Gavin, why did you conduct this study?
Well, I think, firstly, as you say, one of our main reasons was to report our experience using organs from circulatory death donors for combined pancreas and kidney transplantation. And that reflects that the waiting list for pancreas transplantation in the UK is growing and is not currently met by pancreas organs from conventional brain-dead donors. Now, I think some centres view outcomes from DCD pancreas glands with a degree of suspicion and believe that their outcomes are perhaps somewhat poorer. But we'd managed to gather quite a great deal of experience over the last 10 years performing kidney transplants from DCD donors, and we were increasingly comfortable that the pancreas glands from these donors could provide excellent graft function.
Yes, you compared the outcomes of 20 patients whose transplant followed the donor's circulatory death and 40 following the donor's brain death. So what exactly did you find?
Well, I think the first thing to mention is that when we looked at the data, the donor and recipient characteristics in the DCD groups and the DBD groups were very similar. And I think that's important because it highlights that we weren't being particularly stringent in selection of our DCD donors or the recipients, and that we're applying the same criteria to both the DCD and DBD cohorts. And basically, despite this, when we looked at outcomes and we looked at a variety of outcome measures, basically the outcomes in both cohorts were very similar. And these outcomes included biochemical analysis of the kidney and pancreas transplant function, as well as just simple graft survival.
So can you put your results in the context of the current status of simultaneous pancreas kidney transplants in the UK?
Well, as I think I mentioned above, there is undoubtedly some degree of variability among the different UK transplant centres in their use of DCD organs. So, for example, we use now more than 50% of our glands come from DCD donors, but that can be very much less in other centres. And so I think that although the numbers in our study are small and the follow-up period relatively short, I think our results do indicate that there is scope to increase transplant numbers in the UK by using more organs from DCD donors, and that if we did so, we'd still achieve very acceptable outcomes.
So they would be your recommendations, do you think?
I think so. I think we have to look at how we can increase the use of DCD pancreas transplants in the UK. And I think that's perhaps not quite so straightforward because as well as a difference in perceptions as to their usability, there are undoubtedly a greater number of logistical concerns using DCD pancreas. And we'd have to try and overcome some of these concerns as well in order to improve or increase the numbers that we transplant.
Well, thank you, Gavin, very much. I mean, that paper is called Outcomes of Simultaneous Pancreas Kidney Transplantation from Brain Dead and Controlled Circulatory Death Donors. But don't go away, Gavin, because I'll come back to you in a tick. But in the meantime, I want to talk to Michael about a different paper that he's co-authored, and this one's about a treatment for chronic pancreatitis. Chronic pancreatitis in which irreversible injury has occurred to the pancreas, resulting in scarring and loss of its endocrine and exocrine functions. And the scarring also means injury to the nerve ends, resulting in chronic intractable pain. So patients need prolonged high doses of strong painkillers like morphine, which causes its own complications with drug dependence and disruption of intestinal function. But one treatment option in a subset of patients is the removal of the whole pancreas in toto, then isolating the islet cells that secrete insulin and reintroducing these cells into the same patient. This treatment is for pain control and for reducing the severity or preventing diabetes that occurs when the pancreas is removed. The BJS paper is a systematic review that attempts to identify when this procedure is indicated in the evolution of chronic pancreatitis. So, Mike, can you tell us why you did this study?
Yes, Wendy, as you indicated just now, chronic pancreatitis does result in malabsorption and diabetes in some patients, but more importantly, it causes chronic and often intractable pain that requires high opioid use and opioid dependence. Now, as you indicated, total pancreatectomy and islet autotransplantation has been deemed suitable for a small subset of patients with chronic pancreatitis. In fact, NICE has reviewed this issue and has considered the procedure a safe option in the right circumstances. However, we were interested to find out what the outcomes were thus far following the procedures done elsewhere around the world, and also we wanted to find out when during the evolution of the disease the procedure itself was truly indicated, because this isn't very clear up to now.
So you searched various databases of journal articles to find studies of outcomes in patients undergoing this treatment, and you analysed them to see how the patients got on. And what were your results?
Yeah, so we did a systematic review on cohort studies describing outcome following total pancreatectomy and islet autotransplantation using what's described as the MOOS guidelines. And five studies met the criteria for inclusion. This included a cohort of 296 patients. Notably, one study from the US contributed 173 to this group. And what we found out was that the procedure itself is well established, although the technique does tend to differ from center to center. Islet isolation, two of the methods varied from center to center, but the modified Riccardi method is the commonest one that seems to be used. And we also found that the commonest site for autotransplantation was in the liver, using either tributary or the portal vein. The results itself, looking at the analysis following a systematic review, we found that all studies reported a post-operative insulin independence in these patients. And insulin independence, the range varied from up to 50% at 5 years. Notably, only two studies mentioned pre- and post-procedure morphine use and requirement, and one went on to do a qualitative questionnaire on quality of life following this procedure, and found that about 79% of patients had an increased quality of life following the procedure.
There are a couple of shortcomings of the study, aren't there? What about those?
Indeed, there are. I mean, with all studies that are observational and retrospective, you have a bias that comes into play. And also, I think because one study contributed a large number, the results would be skewed towards the outcomes of that study. It's also should be noted that the reporting of outcomes, especially insulin requirement and the usage of analgesics, seems to be inconsistent.
So what do you think this study has told us that we didn't really know before?
I think when you look at the procedure itself, the main objective is to relieve intractable pain and to prevent or reduce the severity of brittle diabetes that results. And it would seem that the procedure does seem to achieve these goals looking at these results. However, what we haven't found is that there's no evidence whatsoever for the optimal timing of the procedure as to when one should carry this out during the evolution of pancreatitis.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mike. And that paper you've been telling us about is called Systematic Review of Total Pancreatectomy and Islet Autotransplantation for Chronic Pancreatitis. Now, I'll turn back to Gavin again to hear about another paper he's co-authored in this BJS. It's about some types of liver transplants. It's a comparison of two sorts of liver grafts, which are both considered suboptimal. One's taken whole after the donor's heart has stopped beating, and as we've already heard, these livers suffer a longer period without a blood or oxygen supply than organs taken from brain-dead donors. And the other lot of grafts are taken when the donor's heart is still beating, but after brain death, and this time the livers split. The right lobe goes to an adult and the left to a child. But splitting it makes it prone to more complications. The paper makes a rare comparison of the outcomes following each of these grafts. So, Gavin, why did you want to carry out this study?
Well, I think precisely for the reasons that you state, Wendy. I think it was important for our centre to compare outcomes of these two types of marginal liver transplants. There's undoubtedly a pressure to use more marginal liver transplants, because the death on the waiting list for liver transplantation currently is somewhere between 15 and 20%. And I was very interested to see if our outcomes for the marginal livers that we use were different for the two groups.
So you compared the outcomes for these two different grafts at the Cambridge Transplant Centre, and one group was adults who'd received the right lobe of a brain-dead donor, and the other group was recipients of a whole liver from a donor whose heart had stopped beating. So what did you find, and what do you think the implications are?
Well, firstly, our outcomes for livers from the circulatory death donors were much better than perhaps we'd have expected at the start of the programme. And in fact, we're really very similar to our outcomes that we see for our conventional whole heart-beating liver transplants. So that was very encouraging. However, our outcomes were poorer than we would have hoped for our recipients of the split livers, in that several of the livers failed early after transplantation and failed for a number of different reasons. And you asked as to the implications. Well, I think our results were surprising, because the different liver UK transplant centres, I think, differ quite markedly in their use of circulatory death livers. So there's clearly some difference in opinion as to their suitability. In contrast, I think adult centres view split livers more favourably, and that's because of the undoubted benefit to the paediatric transplant population from the availability of the left lateral segment to the child. And I think our results highlight that this perception, perhaps that the split livers do better than the DCD livers, isn't necessarily the case.
So do you think this may come as something of a surprise to the transplant community in the UK?
I think it may perhaps it'll come as a surprise in terms of the outcomes of our DCD livers being better than I think is generally perceived. And I note that there's been a study published by King's Hospital in London recently
which again highlighted very comparable outcomes of the DCD livers to the conventional livers. I would hope that both our paper and the paper from King's would emphasise to the UK that there is an important resource of livers that we can use to address the shortfall in our transplant programme. As for the results from our split liver, I think it does highlight that although we often start with what is perceived to be a perfect liver before performing the split, that once we perform the split, that right lobe must still be viewed as marginal. And one thing to mention in relation to the outcomes of splits is, I think it is notable that much of the literature pertaining to outcomes of splits was discussed at a time when the splits were kept within each centre and not transported elsewhere. Whereas nowadays we tend to transport livers and the split livers to other centres, that undeniably lengthens the cold ischemic time, which may be having an impact on our outcomes for the split livers.
Yes, I guess it may explain some of the worst results that you had.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Well, thank you, Gavin, very much indeed. And this paper's called Comparison of Marginal Liver Allograft Outcomes Using Either Adult Split Liver or Donation After Circulatory Death Liver Transplant. And all three of the papers we've been discussing are available in the June issue of the BJS. And that's all from this podcast. We hope you'll join us again.